You may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, I'm Frank Friedman, representing Shevlin Smith, a law firm sued for malpractice by its former client, Bruce McLaughlin. David Hudgens and Reese Pearson, who tried the case, are with me at counsel's table, and I'd like to reserve 7 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
This legal malpractice action involves a case within a case scenario arising from Mr. McLaughlin's criminal conviction that was subsequently overturned. Mr. McLaughlin then hired Shevlin Smith to sue his criminal defense attorneys, and he is now suing Shevlin Smith based on a 2005 release relating to two of the criminal defense attorneys that inadvertently also released a third non-settling attorney, Mr. Volzer. This appeal raises several significant issues in the realm of attorney malpractice, but I'd like to focus first briefly on two trial improprieties, which we think were reversible error in their own right, and get to them before I hit the legal malpractice issues. The ad damnum issue and the legal opinions being sent back to the jury room are two very serious problems, we think. The court let the plaintiff ask the jury for millions of dollars in damages above and beyond the ad damnum. At JA 13, the ad damnum was $6 million, but the plaintiff asked for $10 million and in excess of $10 million. And the court ruled twice, actually, that it would let the plaintiff do that, but that it suggested it would step in if more than the ad damnum were actually awarded. We think this is contrary to Virginia precedent and procedure, and plaintiff has not offered a single case where a plaintiff previously has been allowed to do this. In Waco versus Barber, this court said it was okay for a plaintiff to list component damage amounts so long as the total did not exceed the ad damnum. And that's consistent with Virginia Code Section 801-379.1, which allows a plaintiff to request up to the ad damnum and provides for the plaintiff to be allowed to ask for a lesser amount, but doesn't provide any allowance for asking for more. Plaintiff argues the jury was told argument of counsel is not evidence. So this is allegedly a no harm, no foul setting. And of course, if that's true, no argument of counsel problems would ever be reversible error. Rule 3:2(c)(ii) of the rules of the Supreme Court says every complaint requesting an award of money damages, quote, shall contain an ad damnum clause stating the amount of damages sought. Choosing the amount sought is not a meaningless exercise, which this court said very eloquently in the Powell versus Sears Roebuck case. It's important for notice, it's important for fairness, and it's very important in an insurance context. And as this court said in Rawls versus Commonwealth, a criminal case where a similar no harm, no foul argument was made with respect to sentencing, when a litigant asks for more than they are permitted to obtain, they're expanding the spectrum of possible outcomes upward and literally inviting speculation. Here, to make matters worse, plaintiff had sought to increase his ad damnum. That motion had been denied, and they went ahead and asked for $10 million anyway and were allowed to do it. We also assigned error to the circuit court's decision to send three opinions, written case decisions of this court, back to the lay jury during deliberations. We think this was particularly inappropriate in a legal malpractice context. Why is it wrong to send these cases to the jury room? And the cases are Oliar versus Kerr, Cawthorn, and Lyle. First, it's prejudicial and confusing. Jurors are not lawyers. That's why so much expert testimony was required in this case in the first place. Yet the lay jurors here essentially were given case law and permitted to decipher the law themselves as to the release of some but not all parties without expert guidance. Second, undue emphasis. In fact, the cases sitting in the jury room as they deliberate wound up likely getting more consideration than the expert testimony itself. That's certainly what the Per Year and the Scott cases say. So
well, if something is marked as an exhibit, the statutes indicate that they can be given to the jury. And so isn't a threshold question, was this an exhibit or was it not, or were they exhibits? And I must tell you, I've never seen a transcript like this before. On page 96, the judge says in response to the objections, I think it's admissible and I'm going to admit them. Page 97, the judge says, we'll move in all of the cases under one exhibit number so we don't run out of numbers. The clerk says 79 would be the next. It goes on to page 100. The judge says they're not going to come back as exhibits. And then again, on page 102, the judge says, well, the objection was to their being admitted, wasn't it? Not to their being shown. And then the judge responds, by agreement, we're just showing them. We're not, uses the words, submitting the documents. What happened?
What happened is this. The plaintiff asked to get them in, and the judge started to respond as if that would happen. And then defendant objected vociferously after that happened. The objection at 1186, 1187 of the joint appendix was the objection that, hey, if they're exhibits, they can go to the jury room. The objection at 1184 was, hey, wait a minute, these were never even disclosed. And the court then stepped back and said, wow. And then plaintiff's counsel said, hey, that's you know, those are good arguments. And then plaintiff said, hey, I have a right to show them. I have a right for them to see them. And the judge said, well, if you want to put them on the board, it was cross-examination of an expert. So the whole cases never did go in. What you have is, you know, cross-examination. And this paragraph was on the screen, that paragraph was on the screen. And what the judge said is, if that's all you want to do, if you just want to show them, then we'll let you do that, but they're not going in as exhibits. JA 1188, as you said, said they're not going in as exhibits. We then made a continuing objection to say, we want to make sure they're not going in as an objection, 1190 and 1191. Court says, well, they're not exhibits, we're just showing them. So that's what happened. What follows then, and I'll go into a little more detail just to drive it home. This plaintiff 79, and we think plaintiff affirmatively agreed, by the way. Yeah, I get to show them, but they're not exhibits. That's if you read the whole section, 1181 to 1191, that's what happened. Plaintiff 79 has been in the court clerk's table, and it says, ID'd, not admitted. That's what they are. Now, I'm going to go into a little extra detail here, just, and it's in the reply brief. The judge also told counsel to work with the clerk to make that table. And then the next day, the clerk came in with, you know, with the table, and they had objections to the table from pages 3 to 21 of that transcript. It's not in the joint appendix, and I apologize for that. But Exhibit 79, so-called Exhibit 79, Plaintiff 79, never showed up. Then the judge tells them, I'm sending these exhibits, all the exhibits, you will have them. And all the exhibits were sent to the plaintiffs, to the jury. But the cases weren't, because they weren't exhibits. The court clerk got it right. The judge started off like he was going to give it, but in the end, they weren't exhibits.
When the jury asked that the cases be sent back, I can't find in the record at that point where there was an objection that they were not admitted as exhibits.
I think two things about that. The first one is we asked for a continuing objection that they weren't exhibits. The second is, and that's at 1190-91. I mean, it was part of the agreement. We were clear. These things aren't exhibits. But regardless of that, at that point, all the objections, and I will step back briefly, the objections that were made were all valid reasons. Whether they were exhibits, you know, assuming they're not exhibits, and they're not, the other objections that are made are dead on.
But if they're not exhibits, we would be ruling as a matter of law whether the court violated 384. If they are exhibits, then we're looking at whether the court abused its discretion as to whether they were confusing. Would that be a distinction in what you're asking us to do?
Well, I guess what I'm saying is that on this record, they're not exhibits.
And I don't disagree with you. I don't think they are, but I'm just trying to figure out. When the jury asks, send us the cases, I don't see an objection that says, Your Honor, you can't do that. They were never admitted as exhibits.
Okay. I guess all I can say is we ask for continuing objection before that.
That they not be
that
exhibits.
That they not be and that they're not. And we're assured that they weren't. In post-trial motions, again, same thing. But then we come down to look at the reasons that were given at that time. And there are three important ones. We've already discussed it's prejudicial and confusing. We've already discussed undue emphasis. What we didn't really get down to is the Cawthorn case, which was discussed ad nauseum at that point. And that case has a really bad paragraph in it. And that case is before 801, the release in that case is before 801.335.1. And what you have there is the final paragraph saying, basically, if you give an unconditional release, you've given away the farm. And Mr. Shevlin at 1105 in his testimony said, I relied on that case. So if the jury, untrained, never seen the whole case before, gets the whole case in the jury room and reads that wrong, it's very damaging because this was not an unconditional release. If you look at pages 1641 to 44, this was a very carefully tailored to 801.35.1 release. In fact, the release that was originally sent to Mr. Shevlin was unconditional, and he changed it specifically to tailor it to the 801.35.1.
Mr. Freeman, you've got some other issues here that are looming large, namely the collectability question and the non-economic damages. You want to pick one of those and go after it?
Sure. Let's turn to the central attorney malpractice issues. The court has phrased a plaintiff's burden for recovering damages in an attorney malpractice case as a but-for test. That is, the plaintiff in a legal malpractice case has to show that but for the alleged malpractice, the plaintiff would not have suffered the damages he now seeks to recover from his former attorney. That's Hendricks versus Daughtry, Gregory versus Hawkins. So hypothetically, if a plaintiff is suing an estate that only contains $50,000, if the attorney suing the estate commits malpractice, the maximum recovery is the $50,000 that was available versus the estate, not millions if the attorney that he's suing happens to be a millionaire, and not millions if the plaintiff winds up getting very, very upset that he didn't get the $50,000 that was maybe his father's inheritance. And that's because the role is to make the person whole again. And this issue manifests itself, not greater, but to make them whole. So the issue manifests itself in three ways in this case. First, does collectability even exist in Virginia? And the circuit court ultimately ruled that it does not at JA 1619. Second, if collectability is the law, does any reading of the evidence justify a $5.75 million verdict on this record? And third, if collectability is the law, was it proper for the trial court to tell counsel, I'm going to let you argue that but for clause, but I'm not going to instruct on it? First things first, does collectability even exist in Virginia? The plaintiff says no, which would put Virginia in an extreme minority of jurisdictions in the country. And we cited a number of cases throughout Virginia jurisprudence that we think do support the concept of collectability. Each case we raised, the court kind of deflected, but Staples versus Staples goes back to 1888, and it says if you fail to collect an uncollectible debt, nothing is left. They said, well, there's a debt collection exception, but you know, it's really not. It's there. You have to prove actual loss to the client. Dusterdick says the very same thing, and it was reversed in part as to the payment rule that you have to actually be out of pocket. That was reversed, but you still have to show actual loss. We do think that maybe the best language we have is Campbell versus Bettius, where the court said, this is a quote, plaintiff's, quote, evidentiary burden is to show what they would have recovered in the absence of the, quote, in the absence of the malpractice, not what they hoped for, not what would have happened if some other advice they had gotten was right. You know,
that wasn't part of the language in Bettius, not what they hoped for, not what
that, that's right, yeah, the quote is before
yes,
that.
Let's
yeah,
leave the quote where the quote
right,
was.
Right, right, right. I hope.
Mr. Counsel, let me ask you this question. How is this going to work in this case? I think in this case you would want the plaintiffs to put on evidence that I would have had a judgment against attorneys that were still working and making money, and I could have collected that judgment over 20 years, perhaps longer if I had got the judgment renewed. They put some of that on, not very much, but they put some of that evidence on. They certainly would never do a calculation of $5.73 million. It seems to me that a better way to do this might be if they go forward, the default position would sort of be, well, sure, you can collect a reasonable amount of money from defendants like these, and it would then be up to your clients to put on, at least have the burden of going forward with the evidence of why it would not be collectible.
Okay. I have, I guess, a two-step answer to that one.
Sort of a two-step question.
Yeah, I think I'm going to start with the second one, which is some states do that, mm-hmm. and of course we didn't have the chance here because... You know, the judge ruled there is no collectability in Virginia.
So he wouldn't let you put the evidence on.
We think is wrong.
Okay. I looked for that in the record. I wasn't quite sure where I could find any place where you offered any evidence.
Well, what the judge ruled during the case, I think, was, and I think what Virginia case law says, but I'm getting ahead of myself, I do want to say some states do treat it that way
right.
as an affirmative defense. Virginia never has before.
Okay.
But some state, Michigan does, for example. But the point is, what the judge said and what Virginia law is now, previous to this case, is that the plaintiff does have the burden of proving. Dozens of cases say, hey, it's the plaintiff's burden to prove their damages. If the court wants to make it an affirmative defense, there are states that do that. But here, assuming it is the affirmative duty of the plaintiff to put in the evidence, they're woefully short here. I mean, to be honest, if we... forget the fact that they actually willingly settled with Graham and Shuey for $50,000. They're going to say that, oh, nobody did any research to show whether they had more or less. Well, they had that chance. They don't have more or less. In fact, they talked to Mr. Keats, the attorney for them, and he said, that's all there is, $50,000. And by the way, you can take it or it's going to get burned in litigation costs. So if there was something else, they failed to show it. Here's what they did.
Counsel, could you answer my question? In the first case against the attorneys, had that been filed, and what was the ad damnum clause? Is that part of this record at all?
The first case, I think, did have, if I'm remembering the case.
If it's not in the record, we don't know, but I couldn't find it, that they filed a case against both sets of attorneys, settled with one. Did they actually file the case?
Are those pleadings in the record? It is not in the joint appendix. If you look at JA6, they acknowledge in their complaint that the claim was made, and it was made in tort and contract, which is very important, but I'm going to come back to that.
But was there an ad damnum clause?
I believe there was, and
okay.
want to...
I'll see if it's in there.
Okay. It was an exhibit at trial, and I believe it was...
It says $18 million.
I believe it was $18 million.
Okay.
But that was before... Well, okay. What you have... Let's look at these other lawyers real quickly. Shuey, the income stream, he had none. He was retired, 1068-69. As to Graham, who never worked on the case, he never worked on it, but was Shuey's partner, he had some limited property that was in a spendthrift trust, some property in his wife's name. His actual income was $100,000 to $125,000 a year in dwindling amounts. That's JA 672. And years later, he did actually get $400,000 from that spendthrift trust after the case had settled. Now, Bolzer... Again, literally, the plaintiff provided no evidence that he had income. And the court specifically said that at JA 1539. He said he just never did it. But what plaintiff did argue is that Bolzer had $2 million in insurance. And that's really what this case is about. At 1078, that's what Mr. McLaughlin argued to the judge when he was fighting off collectability. Yes, there was $2 million in insurance. And that's what he told the jury in opening at JA 633. The problem is that then later the parties agreed to an instruction that said don't consider insurance. And that's at JA 306. So here's the bottom line. We've said this earlier today, but on plaintiff's best day, given every penny that Graham made for 20 years at $100,000, and that wouldn't happen because there'd be taxes and whatnot, that's $2 million. Include Volzer's insurance policy, even though it's contrary to the instruction at page 306. That's $2 million. Give him the $400,000, which he would have never gotten, but it's still not $5.75 million. And another interesting point, if you look at JA 995 and 917, the economic damages that they had coming into the trial were $1.2 million. That's what their experts said going into trial. And so, ironically, plaintiff's counsel said twice at 995 and 917, hey, if you scour our discovery record, we actually have $3.5 million in economic damages.
And so I don't want to cut you off, but you're running out of time.
Yeah.
Can you talk about your assignment error 8 a little bit?
I sure can. And thank you for raising it, because it's a very important one, and thank you for giving us extra time, because this case has a lot of issues. We asked the court to address whether failing to anticipate a future shift in the law constitutes malpractice. And this case was triggered by settlement and release of two of plaintiff's original three criminal defense attorneys. These two, again, had very limited funds, $50,000. They were going to be gone if they didn't accept this money. The settlement occurred in 2005. And at the time it was signed, there were dozens of Virginia cases that said attorney malpractice sounds in tort even if the duty breached is premised in contract. It's a hybrid action. The year after the settlement agreement was signed, 2006, this court issued Cox versus Geary, which stated bluntly and for the first time that a negligent attorney is not a tortfeasor. And therefore, Virginia Code Section 35.1 does not operate to permit release of some tortfeasors without releasing others. And under Cox, release of one attorney equaled release of all of them. The upshot of this ruling was that Mr. Volzer, for the first time, shows up, the release had happened 4 months ago, and say, hey, I'm released under Cox. And that was the alleged malpractice below, letting that $2 million insurance policy get
away. So what's the standard of care of the attorney?
The standard of care is, I think, reasonably interpreting the law and handling the situation. And I'm going to go another 2 minutes, I think, with the court's indulgence, because this really is important. As of 2005, when Shevlin Smith drafted the release in question, there was not a single case holding that 801-35.1 does not apply to attorney claims. Plaintiff's expert, Mr. Maines, admitted that at JA 1053. We have a fairly thorough discussion of it in our brief, but a representative sample, Lyle says actions against attorneys for negligence are governed by the same principle as other negligent actions. Katzenberger is a case where some landowners were suing in contract, and the court says, and the attorney who messed up the transaction, he's a tortfeasor. Now, that's a case from the 60s, but that same language reappears in Cawthorn, the case that went back to the jury, by the way. Goodstein versus Weinberg is a case where this court applied a tort statute of limitations. The point is, there was a hybrid out there, and more importantly, there was also case law indicating that 801-35.1 was going to be liberally, or at least loosely, analyzed. Here's an example. Thurston said the statute's not limited strictly to joint tortfeasors because we're going to apply it to vicarious liability. Heyman is a case where the court said, hey, we're going to apply, we can apply it to covenants not to sue and to a release, even though the language is a bit sketchy as to a release. But here's the big one. Tazewell Oil, which involved settlement of a contract and tort claim together, this court ruled this did not violate 801-35.1 or defeat its protection. In that case, there were tort claims and warranty claims together. And at 243 Virginia 94, 106, the person who was released, wasn't released, said, hey, by doing the tort and contract together, you messed up. You have to, you know, it's a problem. And this court said, no, doing exactly what Mr. Shevlin did here is okay.
And you're saying as a matter of law that was not malpractice, based upon your argument.
I'm saying it's not malpractice.
As a matter of law. It should have gone to the jury.
We argued that, yes, as a plea and bar, and we argued it again in a motion to strike. And let me just say that the Circuit Court said this was a sea change and said it's a different world. And plaintiff's counsel argued that Cox changed the Lyle rule, and that's why they said no contributory negligence instruction in this case. The legislature promptly changed the statute to show that there was a change in what they had expected. You have Bolzer coming forward. He had never come forward before. We think failing to follow Cox would be a problem, but failing to anticipate that ruling in advance is not. And we asked the court to look at that with an eye both to Hayward Construction, its own decision dealing with, you know, change in law, but also the D.C. Biomet case we cite in our brief, which talks about operating in a gray area, because this was a very murky gray area. And under plaintiff's analysis, every time you make a wrong decision, like maybe when they'll be arguing about the $6 million ad damnum and why they didn't want to change it, it's not every time you make the wrong guess, it's malpractice. It's got to be a little bit careful, reasonable analysis. And that's not what the court said when it read it, when it dealt with our motion to strike. It said, I don't think the law is clear enough for me to rule on this. And we think that's a mistake. Thank you.
All right.
Good afternoon. My name is Tom Clough-John. I'm from Loudoun County. I represent Bruce McLaughlin in this appeal. Before I begin, may it please the court, I wish to adopt and incorporate all arguments in our brief to the event that are not discussed here this afternoon. After 15 years of an ordeal, numerous depositions, pre-trial motions, 4 weeks of a trial with tens of witnesses, including three experts, and vigorous cross-examination, each side had their day in court and an opportunity to be heard. The jury properly considered the evidence and awarded $5.75 million in economic damages, which Sheldon Smith admitted was supported by the evidence, and that's at 1525. A fair trial was heard on the issue of economic damages. Mr. McLaughlin brings to the attention, however, a fair trial was not heard on the issue of other damages, including wrongful incarceration. And he's asking the court to affirm the jury verdict with respect to economic damages and to remand for a subsequent trial on wrongful incarceration damages and to permit an extended ad damnum pursuant to that.
Let me ask you this. Is he entitled to the non-economic damages because this is a tort?
I'm sorry, sir?
Is he entitled to those damages because this is a tort action?
Actually, Your Honor, it's the issue on that is, I think, fascinating, and that's where we get to our discussion in the plea or in the issue of examination. The appellant in this case brought up the Nogiak case, and in that case you cite previous cases such as Sunrise Continuing Care, which this court has said, as a general rule, damages for breach of contracts are limited to a pecuniary loss sustained. However, this court, it knows how to create a bright-line rule, did not create a bright-line rule. In this case, they said as a general rule. And I bring to the court's attention Washington and O.D. Railway versus Westinghouse Electric and Manufacturing Company, which is out of 1916. And I think this elucidates, I think, the standard in a contract case such as this. In determining the amount of damages due for breach of contract or for other assumed obligation, the test is whether the damage is natural or within the actual or potential contemplation of the parties at the time the obligation was assumed. I will assess or tell the court, there is not one citizen in the Commonwealth of Virginia who does not realize that when one is facing felony jury trials, that if they're convicted, they're going to go to prison or potentially go to prison. And there's not one criminal defense lawyer who does not realize that if they screw up, if they commit malpractice, their malpractice may improperly send their client to prison. As a consequence, on the unique case of a legal malpractice involving a criminal conviction or a criminal defendant, the actual potential contemplation of the parties includes the fact that someone could be wrongfully incarcerated.
And well, let me ask you that. If that's the case, what's the difference between that and the dressmaker who's making a dress for a wedding, and you don't finish it on time, and the dress is not there for the wedding? What are the natural and probable consequences of that? The wedding is ruined.
Well,
and the person is very disappointed, and they're heartbroken.
Just Goodman, and I think that's the notion of the Noviak case where they said, in that case, it was harassment damages weren't proven. But I think there's a fundamental difference. In a dressmaker situation, one's liberty is not taken from them. And I think it's hard for the appellant to argue in this case when it would be contemplated.
What we're talking about is foreseeability of damages, not what the damages are.
Well,
what the injury is. It's the foreseeability of the injury that I thought was the relevant aspect of.
Well, I think that in this case that there are foreseeable damages, and then there are issues that are recognized as an injury in this case. We would not necessarily recognize as a compensable injury the degree of someone's humiliation. But because it was a contract and it wasn't expected that someone would be humiliated, in this case, it's clearly contemplated that if someone screws up as part of this contract, someone can go to jail and go to prison. And I think that's the fundamental difference, that it was contemplated by the parties that if there was malpractice, that he would be wrongfully incarcerated. And this court has recognized the concept of the injury being wrongful incarceration, both in Cox v. Geary and in McLaughlin v. Volzer, which was decided a year after that.
But isn't it something different between deciding that wrongful incarceration, which is compensable, and deciding what those damages will be? Because it's my understanding that part of the damages he got here economically was because of the wrongful incarceration. I mean, because he was incarcerated, he couldn't work. And he got damages for that. But I think you want more than that, don't you?
Oh, absolutely. He
okay.
Didn't get damages for being incarcerated. He lost the opportunity to work. But then what that does is it says the liberty interest of any person is clearly tied to their ability to earn money. And the General Assembly and their statute where you can go and seek compensation for being wrongfully incarcerated, the General Assembly has recognized the value of the liberty interest. And when the state does something that compromises that liberty interest, it's compensable. And it clearly doesn't make sense, or it seems to be inconsistent, that if a private party is negotiating a contract, that's what we now talk about, attorney versus client is a contract case, and those damages or that injury is foreseeable, then it should be compensable by that attorney who has screwed up, committed malpractice, and caused the wrongful incarceration. So it's our position that wrongful incarceration damages are compensable in this narrow case of legal malpractice in a criminal case.
But I guess the point I was making is we know that the damages are compensable because you got some of those damages in this case, and the jury was instructed on it. But what are the additional damages that you are asking?
Category. I think someone could possibly have just the deprivation of liberty itself. The under the circumstances where in this case, and we weren't allowed to put on any evidence, but Mr. McLaughlin, the jury could compensate him for the fact that based on the nature of the crime that he was convicted for, he spent 23 hours a day in solitary confinement. He was assaulted in prison. There was attempted rape in prison. These kinds of circumstances and the injuries that are components of wrongful incarceration are something that he could seek. He lost time with his family. He lost solace and companionship with his children. All those are, I think, a component of wrongful incarceration. And that was the litany that went down in terms of Cox, that was identified as these are the forms of wrongful incarceration damages. In this, and we think that those would apply in this particular case as well.
The legal malpractice case is a strange little creature. I think everybody agrees with that. I mean, we talk about it being a contract action that sounds in tort. And then we have cases that say, all right, for statute of limitations purposes, it's contract. Oral 3 years, written 5.
Yes, sir.
But we're going to let you have contributory negligence as well. And that comes from the tort law. And so we try to figure out which what aspects of ordinary principles apply to this hybrid beast? And I thought your argument, and I may be wrong, but and Mr. Freeman, you better be listening up. I thought it was a better argument, is that section 54.13906 reads, every attorney shall be liable to his client for any damage sustained by the client through the neglect of his duty as such attorney. My understanding is that you are arguing that that all these cases about non-economic damages didn't have to do with lawyers. And the General Assembly has said by statute that the lawyer is liable for any damage, presumably that includes non-economic.
I would agree, Chief
Justice. Well, I thought you did in your briefs.
And that's why, and I will tell you, as everyone gets up here and speaks before you, I'm trying to cover 18 assignments of error, and you're right. That's why I asked to rely on my brief to the extent that I don't discuss it. But I would agree with your Honor that that's exactly the case. It's any damage, and this carving out by the trial judge of only economic damage, I understood the rationale he was attempting to apply, but he did not accept our argument under Title 54, and he also didn't accept our argument, which we made numerous times, that this was a criminal legal malpractice is essentially unique. Not only is a legal malpractice a unique creature, but the legal malpractice in a criminal context is further unique. Or I don't know if you can be further unique. Is the most unique? I don't think that's a superlative that can be used as well. It's also unique of a different character because there are even additional elements that have to be proven, such as wrongful innocence. You also have to get get post-trial relief, and then either have abandonment or you have to prove that you were not contributory or actually had committed the crime, etc. This is an area that is, because it is unique, I don't think we're creating a law that says in all contract cases you get non-contract damages or non-pecuniary damages. But as we've said, and this court has said in Lyle when it found contributory negligence, it said this is a contract case, but the implied obligations in the contract are tort obligations. And therefore, one is able to, I think, meld the notion that there, to some degree, you are able to get, or we'll call them tort damages or non-pecuniary damages in the case. I believe the General Assembly in Title 54 clearly said that. And that's why they also would allow for compensation to include wrongful incarceration when someone were to make a petition for the state to compensate them if the state had done something wrong. And that's why I don't think it's excluded in this case, and we believe that the trial judge erred in keeping that aspect out.
Well, Mr. Plotkin, as you just discussed, this is a hybrid and more unique even in the criminal context, and some of this is you're using tort principles and tort-type damages, and some you're not, but you're using statute of limitation for contracts. As the record seems to appear, and has been stated this morning, the idea that the tortfeasor statute did not apply in this particular case had not been ruled on prior to 2005. So what indication would an attorney have to be sure that they were taking either the hybrid part of the action on the tort side or on the contract side? Now, they knew about the statute of limitations, as we already said that, and they knew about contributory negligence, which, of course, is one of each. How is it? Tell me how they should have known. It was very clear that the law would not have allowed that kind of relief.
I think, Justice Lacey, I think there's two parts to that answer. And the first part is if you look at what was pled in malpractice, and I'm going on to the eighth assignment of error in this case, we think that's kind of a red herring in this matter. They said that the circuit court, in denying the second plea in bar, rejected the idea that one does not commit malpractice by failing to anticipate a change in the law. Mr. McLaughlin never pled that failing to anticipate a change in the law was an element of the malpractice they were seeking. Mr. McLaughlin said that the law was established and that there were also four other areas of malpractice. There was malpractice for excluding John Graham. There was malpractice for not exploring all the assets when he was advising him to sign the release under 801.35.1 in the first place so that it was an uninformed decision. There was malpractice in not doing research with regard to 801.35.1. And there's one other that's escaping me at this point. So we have multiple levels of malpractice. Secondly, when we look at it, this is the whole part of the exercise that I think the appellant is so up in arms about when we get to talking about the cases. And Justice Powell, in all respect, I'll disagree, and I think I have a good argument as to why they were exhibits, but I'll get to that one second when I'm finished with Justice Lacey, is that the from 1977, when Ole Ivory Kerr first brought out the notion that the contract between, or the agreement between a lawyer and his client is based in contract, though it sounds in court. We also, at that time, we knew what the common law was. And the common law was if you release one defendant, you release them all. And that was set in stone. As a matter of fact, this court said in Potomac Hospital Center versus Dillon in 1985, the quote, actually there is, in Wright v. Worowski, unfortunately, the rule that release of one releases all sometimes works harsh results. Yet the rule is one of ancient origin, honored without exception in this commonwealth, and this is the kicker, and fully familiar to bench and bar. Both counsel and courts must be governed by it. So if this court is saying that if you're a member of the bar, you've got to know that release of one releases all in a case unless there's a statutory exception. So then we apply statutory exception, 801.35.1 comes along in 1979. And we have a whole series of cases, nothing really on 801.35.1, but we have a whole series of cases that re-emphasize throughout the time period that a lawyer's contract, if there's a dispute between a lawyer and his client, that that's a contract case, not a tort case. And legal malpractice cases are contract cases, not tort cases. Though they sound
tort. The problem with that is it begs the question. And that's what I think Justice Lacey is getting to. How is a lawyer to know whether they're going to apply a tort concept to that or a contract concept to that when lawyers know that there's a contract concept for statute of limitations and a tort concept for contributory negligence? How's a lawyer supposed to know how we will interpret that?
Well, Justice Lemons, let's say a lawyer doesn't know. What is the lawyer's obligation if a lawyer doesn't know? A lawyer is to do research, and the lawyer is to inform their client that they don't know what risk they're going to take.
The problem is that the research they have to do would have to be among seven justices of this court, and they don't get to do that.
Well, in this case, I think that part of the elements of the malpractice the jury got to hear was that Mr. Shevlin did not do extensive research on the issue of 35.1. He said it's a tort, it's always a tort. And he didn't advise his client, Mr. McLaughlin, that he was unsure or that this was a confusing area of the law and that perhaps that they should be cautious or that et cetera. And that's part of the malpractice, and that's what the expert John Main said, is that if you're unsure about an area of the law, you have an affirmative obligation under the standard, the implied duties, to inform the client so that they know what risk they're taking in signing a release. And in this case, that's part of the malpractice that was argued, was that he didn't inform Mr. McLaughlin that this is an area that there's a lot of weird stuff going on with Lyle, because it says that you can get contributory negligence, though we say in Ole Ivory Kerr it's a contract case. And if a client says, well, I just assume because of my past experience working in medical malpractice that it's a tort, and it falls to the detriment of the client has confidence, I think, has a compensable injury in this case because he was denied the opportunity of making an informed decision based on the advice of counsel as to whether to sign that release in the first place. And that is a major component of the malpractice, and that's what we argued to the jury, that's what we established with the jury, was that he didn't do that. He didn't inform McLaughlin. As a matter of fact, if you read the record, Shevlin's response was McLaughlin's an attorney, so he was responsible for figuring it out by himself. And that's certainly not the law, is because the attorney has an obligation in that particular matter. I'd like to move on to the issue, because I promised Justice Powell I want to talk about the issue of whether or not these are exhibits. I thought it was kind of interesting that, based on a previous case, Justice Lemons asked or mentioned the fact that under 511A, the appellant has an obligation to make sure that there is a complete record in this matter. And all of a sudden, at this point in time, we have opposing counsel get up and say, oh, by the way, we don't have Exhibit 79 in the record. And it wasn't listed as by the clerk. And so, therefore, that's an evidence that it wasn't admitted as part of the record. Where's Exhibit 79? Is there a sticker that says it's rejected by the court? Is there a sticker that said it was admitted by the court? The appellant has that obligation to provide a complete record to allow you to make a decision. They haven't done that. I think that the court has to weigh that. Now let's talk about exhibits. Absent that, without the sticker, without any evidence, let's look at the transcript. And I think I can reconcile your questions, Justice Lemons, because this is the way it happened. And I have a little bit more knowledge because I was actually there, not just from the transcript. If you look at 1184, the judge lays out a rule. Nothing gets shown to the jury unless it's admitted as an exhibit. Nothing gets shown to the jury unless it's admitted. Then later on that same page, I think they're admissible because it was shown in cross-examination. It was the basis of the expert's opinion. And I'm going to admit them. On 1185, we're going to mark them under a singular exhibit so that there won't be confusion. At 1186, they are marked and admitted as 79. Now, he doesn't unadmit them at any point afterwards. And this is perhaps a limitation of the English language because you ask, what happened at that point? The question at that point was not whether they were admitted, is whether this stack of cases was going to go back to the jury. And Justice Lacy brought up the idea of 381. 801-381 says it's within the discretion of the trial judge not to send evidence back. And if you read the record there, we have a colloquy about whether they should all go back. And I said, I don't care if they go back to the jury. We at least need to show them, because I knew, as did the trial judge, that if they wanted to see a document, they could always ask for it if it wasn't sent back. So there's this whole discussion that we're not going to show you them as exhibits, we're not going to send them back as exhibits, but that didn't unadmit them. More importantly, when we had that initial statement by the judge, the jury sees nothing unless it's admitted, then he allows from 1191 through 1274 a discussion of all these cases in front of the expert that were all shown to the jury on the screen because we were in the electronic courtroom. Most importantly, and I think this is where the court, and Justice Powell, this is where I think is the most important thing, is the trial judge knew that he had admitted them, and he treated them as admitted when the jury asked for those three exhibits. You're correct. They never noted an objection, and contrary to what the appellant says, their continuing objection wasn't to admissibility, it was to them going back, is the way we read the transcript, and that whether they should have, or whether they would be confusing, not to the fact that they were admitted. When the judge says, I'm going to send them back, they don't object at that point in time. And more importantly, and this is, I think you have to look at it at 1496, he says they asked for four cases, Oliar, Lyle, Cawthorn, and Cox v. Geary. And what does he say? And it's shown on the instruction in the letter on page 316 in the joint appendix. He writes back, Cox v. Geary was not admitted into evidence, therefore you can't have it. But the rest of them, he says that we can go forward. I don't want to paraphrase on it. It's at 316, and it says, this decision is not part of the evidence submitted, and you may consider the testimony discussing that case. So he knew what cases were admitted and what cases weren't admitted, and he didn't allow Cox to go back.
Counsel, what do you make of the judge's statement on 1190 and 1109, where the court says, well, the objection was to being admitted, wasn't it? No, not to their being shown. And then the court goes on to say, by agreement, we're just showing them, we're not submitting the documents.
Your Honor, and it is the nature of the transcript, I took that at the time it occurred, was that the word not admitted, but submitting is different than admitting as evidence. Submitting then, the second part of that is, by agreement, we're showing them, we're not submitting the documents back.
But in the context of, well, the objection was to their being admitted, wasn't it? Not to their being shown.
And I think that in the context of that, because he then talks about submitting, that's what he meant in that case. And I would say, I was told I should lead with this, but I thought it was perhaps not the, I thought the court knew this and everything else, but Mr. McLaughlin stands here as a successful plaintiff with a jury verdict which was affirmed by a trial court, and he's entitled to the inference, all inferences of conflicts in the evidence in this case. And I would suggest that because of the issue, the real discussion was whether the pile of papers was going to go back, that it was really an issue of submitting them back to the jury initially. Then what he did, in totally consistent with 381, was when they asked for them, because 381 says if you hold them back and they're asked for it, you have to give it to them. And that's what he did. And then it was an issue of, I'm not going to just give the part cases that we showed on the screen. He said, I'm going to give all the cases because they were all admitted. So the trial judge was fully cognizant of his record, of his rulings, and there's all, we have the Fredrickson construction case that talks about that we have to give deference to a court and the interpretation of his own orders. And in this case, he clearly acknowledged that he thought he had admitted those exhibits. He not only he thought it, he had admitted them. He was excluding Cox because he hadn't admitted them. And it's the same argument that he made at post-trial at 1546 through 1554. 1546, he repeated, my rule has always been, I don't send any, let the jury see anything that's not admitted as an exhibit, and I believe they were exhibits, and at 1500, he says, or 1550, he says very specifically, when the jury asked for them, they were exhibits, and therefore I sent them back.
Counsel, how does your argument, how is it impacted, if at all, by the fact that the clerk who certified the document shows it wasn't admitted as an exhibit?
Clerks make errors, clerks aren't judges.
Okay.
That's that simple.
That's the record, isn't it? That's the record.
Well, and the issue, actually, and I don't know what the record is, because the record's not complete because they didn't send it. Because the record's supposed to include anything that was rejected and any exhibits that were refused and so forth, and the appellant didn't make sure that this court has an entire record in which to evaluate this on. So, clerks make an edit.
Well, we actually have the whole record.
We have the record.
We were told that you do not have Exhibit 79.
In the joint appendix.
No, you don't have it at all, is what we were told.
You said it's not a part of the record.
Exhibit 79 is not part of
it. I don't think it ever got here from the
Exhibit 79 got never was never presented.
From the court.
And that's their obligation under 511A.
Well,
to make sure it's here.
I think you're talking about something different.
Yeah,
something to be perfectly honest, but we won't talk about the technicality of it.
All right. If I may, then the next question I wanted to talk about was this issue of collectability. And the issue of collectability, collectability is not the law. Collectability hasn't been the law ever in Virginia. They failed to offer a jury instruction on collectability, and we would argue that that's an issue of waiver on that issue because they never offered a jury instruction on collectability.
Let me interrupt a second, though. You don't disagree with the idea that there's a but-for component of this. But for the negligence of their client, you would have recovered this amount of money, right?
I would have. That's malpractice. That's what you said in Cox.
That's right.
That's what you said in Cox.
So is collectability, how does that differ from the but-for?
Well, collectability says, how do I realize satisfaction of the judgment? Okay, that's what the point I was about to make. In Staples, when they said, it's collectability was established in Staples, Staples talked about legal collectability. In that case, it was a debt collection, and there was a malpractice case brought, and the underlying debt that the lawyer was trying to collect had been discharged in bankruptcy. So the lawyer couldn't be responsible for not collecting on that debt when legally it could never have been collected on. So that's an issue of legal collectability, not actual monetary collectability. Because otherwise what we're doing is we're throwing all tort on its head. That means, I've just committed, or all contract damages in this case on its head. But in the concept of malpractice, I have committed malpractice, I better go spend my assets, all right now, because the only thing anyone could ever get against me is what I currently have at that moment. That doesn't make sense. Why doesn't it make sense? Well, first of all, it doesn't make sense because the General Assembly told us it doesn't make sense because under 801.251, we have 20 years to collect on a statute and potentially 40 years to collect on a statute. Secondly, it doesn't make sense because what you would be limiting someone to be able to seek in damages is only those assets that someone knew about within the first 5 years, presuming there's a written contract. So I'm only limited to the damages I could collect within the statute of limitations by the time I had to file and have my trial. As a counsel on the other side noted, John Graham came into $400,000 11 years afterwards. Had there been a judgment against his firm and him personally, because it wasn't a corporation, then under the statute, under 251, McLaughlin would have been able to seek that $400,000. And there's never been anything established by this court that someone has to establish what money is available at the day of judgment, and that's the limit of your ability to collect. In this case, against somebody who's committed damages.
Was that what was claimed? Is that your understanding that collectability was what they could have gotten on the day of judgment as opposed to what they could have gotten at any point from the particular defendants?
It says, plaintiff could have recovered from the criminal defense in the absence of Shevlin Smith's alleged malpractice. And in their pleading, they're saying there's no evidence of what they could have collected. Now, you can't guess. And what I explained to the trial judge, Justice Goodwin, was this. Once the case against Shuey and Bolzer was dismissed, they take actions with their assets because it's not collectible. All right? And so it may be that the reason Graham brought assets out of a trust was because he knew he wasn't going to get hit by McLaughlin. But you can't then hold a litigant to say that I'm going to look at what they did afterwards or what their assets are today and say that would have been collectible. Because it's already, that door is already closed because Shuey and Bolzer had already been determined that they couldn't collect against them. So as a consequence, this notion of you have to establish the wealth of Shuey or Bolzer and that's the limit of collectability doesn't make sense. The jury had to decide how did Shuey and Bolzer damage McLaughlin? And then did Shevlin Smith breach their duty and was that a proximate cause of damage to McLaughlin? And how much was that damage? And that's what they did. They didn't have to make a determination of how much money does Shuey and Bolzer have today and that's a limit of what they could go against for Shevlin Smith. It's never been the law in Virginia in this case. And I actually, contrary to, and I want to point one thing out, this court did not overrule Duesterdick in part. This court overruled Allied Products versus Duesterdick entirely. It wasn't overruled in part, and because this court knows how to do that. They know how to hold out, you know. And that was a case that's totally overruled. There is no case that talks about collectability in this case. I also want to go to the ad danum issue in this case, because that was led off by Mr. Friedman in this case. Contrary to what he said, and I'd like to talk about the Powers case, because the Powers case talks about damages and what notice you have. If you read 13 of the joint appendix, the damages are not $6 million. They're $6 million plus pre-judgment interest. Pre-judgment interest from 1998 at simple interest would be over $11 million. Pre-judgment interest, if it's compounded, would be over $17 million. They were on notice of a very large amount that was in excess of $6 million because we asked for $6 million plus a pre-judgment interest component to it. So as a consequence, there wasn't a limit of merely $6 million. More importantly, this court told the jury that they could not consider any statements in opening and closing, and that they told this court told not this court the trial judge told the jury 10 times 628, 629, 653, 657 to 58, 663, 664, 145, 1327, and 1335. What was said by counsel is not evidence and cannot be considered. Waco, when you read the entire opinion, Waco talks about comprehensively making sure that someone doesn't ask for damages that are not supported by the evidence. And they admitted that if you considered all the evidence, consider McLaughlin's testimony of a 20 to 25% increase, they admitted that there was a support in the record for damages in excess of $10 million, and that's at 1525. I'm down to my last 10 seconds at this point in time. Thank you for listening. I understand it's a complex case. Mr. McLaughlin sits with the cloak of having been a successful plaintiff. In this case, we ask you to uphold the verdict and the jury award and to remand to allow for consideration of wrongful incarceration damages.
All right. Rebuttal.
I'm going to ask the clerk to put an extra 30 seconds on there. That would be fair to Mr. Friedman.
It is
3:36.
I'm happy to go ahead if you
want. Yeah, you go ahead and I'll watch it. Oh, there we go.
Thank you. It's sort of an ironic situation here where Shevlin Smith is on the hook here exclusively because all of a sudden, really without warning, there was a case that said this is only contract, not hybrid anymore, and yet plaintiff is still arguing for tort damages. He spent much of the trial, I'll give you some sites, J1267 to 69, much of the trial convincing the jury that we should have known that this was a contract because you can't get tort damages in this setting. Truth of the matter is they came in with an expert who said you have a maximum of $1.2 million in economic damages. And the judge said, I'm not letting you go above that, but then the expert went to $2 million, and he let him. And we never conceded any kind of $10 million at all. More importantly, holding lawyers liable for emotional distress from a conviction would be a paradigm shift. You'd have, imagine loss of custody, loss of your home, denied your dad's inheritance. The entire bar would be underinsured. It'd be impossible to get somebody to do a court-appointed case for $1,000 if they were going to get $1 million sanction.
I understand all that. That makes perfect sense from a policy standpoint. What does that statute mean?
The statute actually derives back to 1819, and then it was amended in 1849. And if you look at it, it really just doesn't suggest. If it means what they say it means, then every case that the court has decided has been wrong, I think. It just means you can't say, I think in the context of it, you can't show up and not do your job and then say you can't get anything. But in this case, it can't mean if it's a contract, you get tort damages, you get punitive damages, you get any damages, because, you know, if the law is you're entitled to contract damages, then you can get contract damages. Otherwise, the law on this would be crazy. And I'd be remiss if I didn't point out that they changed four of their assignments of error. And the ad damnum ones, they tried to triple their ad damnum. They shouldn't be allowed to. They did it at the last second. They never asked for it again. And really, their attempt to get millions and millions of dollars more is moot. And really, the assignments of error, they changed.
Mr. Freeman, what's your answer to the fact that there was more issues of malpractice presented to the jury than simply the signing the release?
I don't think that those really came to the core here is...
Was that evidence presented to the court?
There was evidence presented... they could go back and say, did you have a long chat with him about what you're doing here, and maybe it would be a disputed question of fact. You know, our guy says he did. He had a long talk with Mr. Keats, and $50,000 was all there was. Again, this was a contract and a tort. He settled them together. Under Tazewell, we have a case that says that's okay. And last but not least, they said Cox was not considered. It came after the release. That's why it wasn't considered. And if I could add one more.
No, I don't think so, because then I'd have to give him more.
Thank you.
I'm sure you're right. That's why I'm not doing it.
Thank you for giving us the extra time.
Yes, it is. Gentlemen, you probably know there's a statute that makes it clear that if you don't put something in your brief, it's waived. But if you don't do something in your oral argument and it's been in your brief, it's survived. So there are things that you didn't get a chance to address. Rest assured, they are before the court, and we will consider them all. Court's in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.